So the topic of my lecture is morality and personality. Suppose for a minute that the topic is money and personality. Money is a social institution, just like morality is a social institution. Would anything about my lecture be different if I were to talk about money and personality? Would there be any difference at all? This question may sound almost ridiculous to you because there's so much difference between money and morality, isn't there? But when you start thinking about it, you can see that after the first reaction that they're so different, the history of money and the history of morality as institutions have actually much in common. And I will try to show to you that money and morality serve a very similar social role. It will turn out that there is a significant difference between money and morality, and it will only help us to sharpen the contrast between personality on one hand, on one side, and the social institutions like morality and money on the other. So let me begin by giving you a short clarification on the definition of how I use these three central concepts: money, morality, and personality. So think of money not as a paper banknote of 10 pounds, but as a social institution on which our money, on which our economy is based, and which is the way of trade and exchanges of most diverse kinds. One of the most important things that characterizes money as a social institution is that it makes most various things commensurable. You want to buy a car and you come up with a credit card, or maybe you change your mind and buy an airplane or helicopter or horse instead of car. Never mind, you can still use your credit card just the same. You can go to another country and you know the equivalence of your money and what you can get for your money and so on. So money allows us to make exchanges, to make trades, to make purchases of the most various kinds at any place in the world, with any person in the world, with any object that is for sale. Money also, besides making things measurable, money also establishes a distance between us and things. Okay? They are for sale, they are for purchase, they are just axes and wires. It also establishes the distance between people. You give me the good that I desire, I give you the money or my credit card number, the transaction is done, we were strangers before, and we continue to be strangers afterwards. If there's one word to sum up what we mean by money as a social institution, a good candidate would be having. You have it or you don't. Another good word would be possessing. You possess it or you don't, or you own it or you don't. Let this be enough as a preliminary clarification of how we use the term money. That's an umbrella word that stands for a whole institution and a whole complex of things. Another umbrella word. I would pretend here that there is no significant difference between ethic and ethics, morality and ethics, morals and moral, and so on. So I will consider them under one umbrella word, morality. And by that I would mean a system of social rules, a system of accepted rules or norms or laws or prescriptions that regulate our behavior, that teach us, point out to us what is right and what is not, what is permissible and what is not, what is appropriate to do and what is not. noticed right away that morality has one very similar feature with money. The moral norms from the very earliest one, like the Golden Rule or the Ten Commandments, do not refer specifically to any individual, to any personality. The commandment, do not kill or do not steal, is equally valid and equally applicable to any human being whatsoever. It doesn't matter whether you're male or female, English or not. The commandment is the same. The moral norm is the same. Okay. Again, if there's one word to stand for morality, it would be the word action. Morality is about acting, or action, acting maybe better than action. And by that I mean not just doing something, but sometimes, but also refraining to do something. That's an action too, right? It's refraining to do certain things. Somebody insults you, and instead of you insulting that person back, you just walk away. You just don't say a word, and you just walk. That's an action too. That action is not just pushing somebody or verbally abusing somebody back. Personality is another complex word. And one of the most important things that I want to do is to distinguish it from individuality. So a person and individual are two different things for me. And this is the key to the things that will happen later. I will give you a provisional definition of personality in the following way, and I'm using the German philosopher Herder. Personality means being human in your own way. Being human in your own way. The two elements here that are very important, that are key to personality. One is that being human. You are a human being. You're part of that group that's called humanity, that has certain expectations and obligations and characteristics and so on. And you never forget that. Which you sometimes do when we talk about individuality, right? But you're also human in your own way. And the fact that you're human in your own way is also important. It's not something accidental, not something to be overlooked, not something to be suppressed. On the contrary, that's something to nourish, and that's something to preserve, and that's something to cultivate. Okay. So personality is about characteristics of personality that I want to emphasize a little bit further. One is uniqueness. Each one of us, each person is unique. Each person is unlike any other. And the second one is that with personality, there's an expectation that we have to develop our personality, that we have to grow as persons. That when you are at the age of 20, or maybe let's start at 10, it would be inappropriate if at the age of 20 you're still at the same moral and mental development as at the age of 10. And when you're at the age of 40, that it would be inappropriate if nothing has changed in your life and you still see the world as if you're 20 years old. Right? There's a certain development, there, growth that is expected from personality. And both of these features, uniqueness and development, is what's going to cause friction between morality and personality in a way that I would outline a little bit further, but I think you can already anticipate some of the problems that are going to happen there. If there's one word that stands, please come in. If there's one word that stands for personality, in literature, you usually find the word being to stand for personality. This is who I am. This is my being. Right? But I would want to shift the emphasis slightly, and when I think about personality, I think more of the work personal way of doing. So I'm seeing you as persons, not as objects, but as subjects. And I'm treating you in a personal way, not in a way in which I would treat my pen or my notebook. There's something different there, right? Personality is something personal. It's the way of facing people and even the way of facing things, because you should show our respect even to pencils and notebooks and chairs and everything else, right? That's also kind of morality toward which I would hope to redirect you at the end of the lecture. So we have these three keywords: money, morality, personality. We have these three catchphrases, if you want: having, acting, and being. So let's now go first into the relationship of money and morality before we look at that friction, potential tension that exists between being the person, being who you are, and morality and money. That's on the other hand. In this part of my lecture, I would rely very much on a book that's now neglected, but I recommend very much to you if you're interested in these topics, especially about money. It's called The Philosophy of Money. The Philosophy of Money by German sociologist and philosopher Georg Simmel, S-I-M-M-E-L, Georg Simmel. The book was published in 1900, so 123 years ago. It's a masterpiece. It's a very complex book, have no illusions about it. But then Kant's Critique of Pure Reason is a masterpiece, even though it's a superbly complex book. So Simmel is the one who caught my attention after I sent my abstract to you about what my lecture is going to be, about how similar money economy and morality really are. And Simmel kind of pulled my attention, not in the same terms in which I'm going to present to you, about three stages in the almost parallel development between money or money economy and morality. And because we don't have too much time, I will oversimplify a little bit. Thanks for you and the question and answer period. We can go back into some further detail. I want to you to think about the development of money and morality in three stages. The first of these stages I will call organism, the second organization, and the third agency. Okay, let me try to explain each one of them. In the first stage of the development of both money and morality, we're talking about early history of humanity. We're talking about the time when either a money economy is well established. So if you imagine, we can go back to the Renaissance or even before. One city in Italy is using these kind of coins, another city is using another kind of coins. You go to Austria, they use something else. It's very difficult to do any trades, right? People wanted not just to exchange goods, but to find a common measure that they could use in exchanging trades. And the trade was blossoming at the time. People were coming from China to trade, or the Europeans were going to Middle East to buy spices or to get different things. But in terms of the domestic situation, almost all families lived three or sometimes four generations together. And there was the head of the family, but the head of the family was really there to implement the tradition. And every member of the family, which was really a community, which was really like an organism, was like a part of a body. And when one little thing it hurts, the whole community suffers because of it. That was, in kind of philosophical terms, there was the time before the separation of the subject and the object. That's kind of pre-object. Nobody is the object and nobody is the subject. Everybody's working together, everybody's living together, everybody's trying to protect the interests of the family and continue the tradition on which the family and the region and the country and the religion and the race was based. Okay, so that's the first period. What happens in the second period is I call an organization rather than an organism, similar but different, is if there's a sharp separation of object and subject, and there's a very strong tendency toward objectification, toward objective rules, toward objective rules, toward establishing something that could have not just family validity, validity for family, but validity for the whole country and even for the whole world. Establishing a way to exchange the currencies across the world, whether you are in the UK or whether you are in China, whether you are in Madagascar. This is the kind of the world economy and the kind of world morality was made, established. In terms of morality, maybe I'll just mention two names that belong to the very peak of that tradition, at least that's how I imagine this, Immanuel Kant and John Stuart Mill. And one thing to see that organism is based on tradition, organization is always based on rational arrangement. That Kant and Mill did understand rationality differently. Kant thought that reason and intelligence can be normative, and Mill thought that it could be instrumental. But the idea is that the world should be organized on rational principles. Both money economy and morality should be based on rational principles, on rational deliberations, and on the kind of principles that every intelligent person anywhere in the world would understand and be able to prove of or disapprove of. Something that we have an expectation of when we're doing science today. If there's an experiment, scientific experiment that's done here in Oxford, under similar circumstances, the outcome of that experiment should be same, even if it's performed in Japan, even if it's performed in the United States. That kind of almost scientific-like objectivity. Being able to establish something that would almost have to use the economy of person, universal currency, whether it's a moral law or whether it's an economic, some kind of a policy or something like that. The third stage that I call agency, the way I understand it, is almost like a rebellion against that second stage. It's where we are right now in the last 150 years. And the shift, moves totally toward the subject rather than the object, toward subjectivity rather than the objectivity. And this is where the person, where the concept of an individual being an individual becomes so important. Because it seems that as an individual, I can do whatever I want. Why should I care about the moral rule? There is no such thing as the moral rule. There's no such thing as absolute value. There's no such thing as anything that people in the past pretended to be. Those are all conventions, and conventions are replaceable, and conventions are valid as long as they serve their purpose, and when they don't, they're just replaced or abandoned. It's like the American foreign policy, you can say, whenever suits the American purposes. One day, one month, it's this way, the next month is the total reversal, but now they are there believing, no, this is the case. We are defending international justice, right, through the American lens. So we have started to behave like that. Let me give you another example, kind of parallel way of understanding it. In the second stage, in the stage of rational, intellectually based organization, it's as if some big institution, whether it's the state or the church or the union or whatever, is telling us, we know what is good for you, follow us. We have established the objective understanding of goodness, of happiness, and all you have to do is just be a good boy and good girl, obey the rules, follow the rules, and you'll be happy, and your soul will go to heaven, or whatever version of good life you're hoping to hear. In this third stage of agency, we are reversing the roles. We say, or even the institutions into which we don't believe anymore, the trust in pretty much all the institutions is completely undermined, whether judicial or political or economic and so on. The idea is now, you know what will make you happy, and you know what you want, and we are here to provide. And the most visible symbol of that is Amazon.com. You tell us what you want, and we are delivering. We are on your way, right? It's your money, it's your life, and who but you can decide what you really want, right? And as we all know, while it sounds really exciting in the beginning, after a while, you don't even open that Amazon.com package for 3 days, because 3 days later, you're not so sure that's what you really need, and so on. Or even if you do open it, I know how many books I order, and then by the time they arrive, I'm already reading something else, and my mind is who knows where. And then maybe 6 months later, if I'm disciplined enough, I will read that book that I purchased, and so on. Amazon.com. I know what I want. But it gives me the sense of authority and control over my own life. Okay, so we have these three stages, and in the third stage of agency, money and morality somewhat separate in their ways of handling it. Another way to put it is this: the morality as an institution is in a big crisis. We have crisis. I mean, we don't know what's right and what's wrong, and who's right and who's wrong. And how could we, if each one of us is to decide what's right and what's wrong and what's good for us and what's not? Right? So what we have in our age is a lot of individualism, very good community, a lot of loneliness, a lot of separation, a lot of longing for community, for meaningful relations with others, and a lot of inability to know how to go back to community, how to establish meaningful relations one more time. So we live in an age in which money blossoms, economy blossoms. It seems that there's hardly anything that money cannot buy. Try sometimes that as an exercise. Make a piece of paper or make a note on your computer. Try to make a list of the things that money cannot buy. It's going to be a short list, or at least you think that. You struggle to come up with a substantial list of things. That's the extent to which money, not morality, dominates our life. Let's go back to personality, to bring personality into this picture. There are two dangers for personality, two things that can undermine personality. One, if we live in society that turns us into a cog of the machine, a cog in a machine. I grew up in communism. I need to explain more about how you feel pointless and worthless, and you just do what you're told to do. But you don't have to live in communism. You can work in a factory, and all you do for 8 hours is move things A to one thing from place A to place B, or attach the things together and then attach them again and attach them again. And that's what you spend a good portion of your life doing. Not very exciting, right? Being a car and a machine, that destroys personality. You're just a tool, you're just an extension of a machine, not a person. The second thing that destroys personality is precisely this individuality that I was talking about a minute ago, the kind of individuality that thinks, I have, I'm master of my own life, and nobody's gonna tell me what to do and how to live my life. It's kind of a 16-year-old mentality, a teenage rebellion mentality, right? And some people never seem to outgrow that stage for the rest of their life. Well, at 16, it's a normal and good and maybe healthy reaction to learn to stand against your parents or the desires of others to tell you what to do with your life. It's not a good thing to continue living the same way without taking into serious consideration the desires and the needs of other people. So, so these two things could destroy personality, right? Both when we are being into that machine that's crunching us, and we just have a uniform and we're just yes men, yes women, or when we think that nobody but me, I can do absolutely whatever I want to do, and who's to say a word about it, right? Now, let's turn the other way around. Personality can be dangerous for you in two ways. Morality is a system of rules, of prescription, of norms that are supposed to have personal, universal application. Even to consider how you as a unique individual feel about a certain rule, and whether perhaps you as a unique individual should violate that rule because there's something about you or your situation that is more important than that universal rule, that either destroys morality or destroys the personality, but it can go together. So it says morality demands universal acceptance, validity, obedience, while personality seem to seriously consider making an exception from a rule that's expected to be valid for everyone. That does demand a situation. For instance, you're starving. You know that you shouldn't be stealing food or stealing money, but you're starving. Your children are starving. And are you going to say, no, I'm not going to steal, that's bad, I know that's bad? You think that the situation is so dear that you're justified in violating the rule. That the situation is that you'd be stupid or irresponsible if you don't steal food to bring it to your children who are going to starve otherwise, right? Those kind of considerations, that there's a conflict between personal interests that are not necessarily selfish interests, right? It doesn't have to be you, it could be your children. And you have a responsibility as a parent. And the objective moral laws and the objective moral norms. The second kind of problem that personality leads to or creates for morality is mainly the development of personality. You know, immorality, especially in that agency period or even the objective period, we assume when we say that stealing is always bad and murder is always bad, we don't care whether you're 20 years old or 50 years old. We don't care whether you're a genius or whether you're the most average person in the world. We don't care whether you're going through any stage of transformation in your development or not. But think about it from the point of view of personality. There's probably four or five stages that almost all of us go through in our lives with regard to our moral development. Okay? It's the first stage when infant, let's say, it's pre-moral stage. An infant has no clue over what's right and what's wrong, no clue. That may be a pre-moral stage, but that's a stage in life. A stage in life is early childhood, maybe teenage years, when there's some excessive, individual interest, individual relativism, let's say. What's good for me? What does that do to me? Right? There's this almost obsessive concern with what does that have to do with me? What does that give me, bring me, and so on? And then when we grow up a little bit later, closing in our 20s and maybe even earlier than that, there's also kind of, we grow into the stage when we understand, well, we're part of a family, or we're part of a sport team, or we're part of a course. And we start to think, what's good for the family? What's good for the team? You know, sometimes the coach benches the player, and the coach says, but that's good for the team. You can't just think about yourself. It's good for the team, right? And what's good for the country, and what's good for the church, and so on and so forth. And then there's a fourth stage that we can see in life, when we, some people call it moral naturalism. And in other terms, you can say, this is when you become a good utilitarian. You start to think about some kind of utilitarian calculus in terms of, okay, what are the consequences of these actions, right? And you understand the complexity of the situation, that sometimes what's good for your family is not necessarily good for another family, or what's good for this, for one person. So you're trying to see what are the good long range and short range consequences, and what consequences should be avoided. It's kind of mature people, when we are ready to make compromises, we are still pursuing what's the best, but we are ready to make compromises, because they have to be made in practical life. And then some philosophers believe that there's an even next stage in life, a higher stage in life, that they call moral realism. Again, these are just terms, but what's more important is that some people come to believe that some values are not just instrumental values, right? Not just good for, good having good consequences, but they are intrinsically good, they're inherently good, they're good in themselves, or they're good in some kind of way that's unconditional. Like being faithful not just to your spouse or to your girlfriend or boyfriend, but being faithful to your friends, being faithful to the people that mean the most to you in life, right? Or trying to be truthful. Even think about, if you can imagine just a society in which everybody's corrupt, fortunately there are such societies, would the value of truthfulness be of any consideration? Should it be of any consideration to anyone? But you know that the person actually is corrupt, and you're corrupt, and why should anybody be so foolish to try to be truthful in a society in which everybody's corrupt? Don't you feel intuitively that truthfulness is still important, even if everything's corrupt, even if nobody actually follows or lives in accordance with truthfulness? So you think being a person, it's very much, being a person is a task. Being a person is something that we have to develop for the rest of our lives. And the question is whether there is any end to that development ever. So it very much varies whether I'm in a certain type of moral situation, whether I'm young and inexperienced, and whether I'm far more mature than I was when I was 20 years old or 15 years old, and so on. So you see, that seems to potentially undermine morality. That seems to potentially bring me to a situation where I can say that no matter what the morality is, there are certain things that are so sacred to me that I would never violate them. It could be that everybody else thinks I'm doing wrong or not. For instance, I think that murdering other human beings is so bad that even my country wants to, for instance, I stayed away from my native country for 9 years because I knew that I'll be sent to military to go to war and form Yugoslavia right away. And as a conscientious objector, I would probably go to jail for like 10 years at that time, right? I would go home. But I would not go to war, and I would not kill people who have done nothing wrong to me, or even if they have done something. Right. So consideration of that kind of thing, you start thinking that some values are so important, and so important to you, maybe not important to other people at all. Maybe they should be important to other people, but they're not. And you cannot look at what other people are doing and how they're behaving and what the majority of people think. It's not the question of the majority. It's not the vote. Voting matters. It's the question of ultimate commitments, of ultimate things that you believe in with all your being. And that's what personality is related to be. Okay. So there's a problem. It's a pension, potential pension. It's just one of the reasons why in most moral philosophy, most moral thesis, people don't talk about personalities. They ignore personalities. We don't care who people are and how unique they are. We're talking about some X's and Y's. And if I have a feeling that not that that our uniqueness is not something that can be disregarded that lightly, or that should be disregarded that lightly, that somehow we should try to see if there may be a way to take that uniqueness count, to find a way that we can reconsider what we understand by morality and what we understand by personality, to see if maybe we need a new stage in the development of morality and personality, if a possible integration of morality and personality can somehow be accomplished. Especially now that I think morality is undergoing a very severe crisis. Okay, so I'll give you just two suggestions because we are kind of running out of time that was given to me. And one suggestion you the morality proper. And the question could be phrased in this way: do we want to understand morality in a kind of a minimalistic way or maximalistic way? Okay, what do I mean by that? Well, for instance, you can imagine or think, or we can be convinced that all that morality has to do to serve its role, the proper morality, is kind of preserve the status quo and preserve certain elements of decency, propriety, and so on, right? So whether I come from the United States or whether I come from Mauritania, I have certain expectations how I should behave here as a speaker. And whether you, as my audience, come from I don't know where, I have certain expectation of what's proper for you to do or not. If you start shouting in the middle of my lecture, that's not proper. Right? It's not civilized. As you like to say here in Britain. Let's be civilized, of course. So that's kind of a minimalistic conception of morality. Morality is the guarantee of certain order, stability, rules, expectations, decency, and so on. And it's important to have it, and every society needs to have it. Okay. But perhaps we should expect more from morality. Perhaps we should expect from morality what the Greek philosophers, ancient philosophers, expected from morality, and that is that morality leads us not just to preserve the status quo or to preserve decency, not infringe upon each other's rights, but that morality should lead us toward the best possible human life. Okay? What if the moral question is not how do we preserve the status quo and how do we make sure that everybody feels comfortable and people don't feel threatened and people don't feel insecure for their existence and so on? It's rather the moral question is, especially in our age when the news are so bleak, whether they come from the Middle East or Ukraine or the rest of the world, instead of thinking, how people should think like that to each other. Maybe the maximalist, moralist approach that I would certainly favor is to start thinking, when are we as human beings at our best? How can we be the best we could possibly be, both in terms of being human, humane, and in terms of developing our own individual gifts and dispositions in such a way that they enable us to flourish, that they enable us to bring positive energy to what we do, sensitivity, responsibility, accountability for everything we do. So the morality will not be about what's right and what's wrong, what's the best. How can to teach us to help us become the best we could possibly be? And then certainly morality would have to include and be sensitive to how different we are and how each of us have different gifts and what the expectation for one person is, how that person could be the best. It would be slightly different, at least from another person. What would it mean for that person to be his or her very best? Okay, there's one more topic that's perhaps the most difficult and the most crucial in this whole story. I'll try to present it to you briefly, and then maybe we can come back to it. And the point is this. When we want to take our uniqueness into consideration, when we take seriously that we are unique individuals, how can we know that our judgment, that our perception of who we are and what our gifts are not completely arbitrary? How do we know that they are no better, that they are no better than us buying something on Amazon.com? You look at something and it looks appealing and you just click that button and it's ordered. On what ground can we decide what is truly good for us as unique individuals? What ground? How do we know that that's not completely arbitrary? How do we know that what I think is good for me now as a unique individual, that I'm not going to change my mind in 3 days or 3 months or 3 years? And yet, in the meanwhile, I would do certain things that would have long-term consequences and effects on my life and the lives of others. Here's a bridge, a hint, a possibility that we could explore later. And it all depends on one issue that we rarely discuss these days, but it's very fundamental. And that is there a continuity or discontinuity between nature and morality? Okay? Is there a complete gap? Or is there some kind of a continuation, a basis in morality which has to be sublimated and cultivated further? Okay? Fortunately, in the last several centuries, there's an anti-metaphysical term, and almost anti-naturalistic. Everything that's nature is, like in Freud's psychoanalysis, instinctive, primitive, irrational, uncontrollable, barely controllable, and so on. Naturalist sentiments in our lives. And what we do, what we want is social programming, like Huxley's Brave New World, right? We have a program and we learn the program and we learn our role and place in a world, and it's so beautiful. It doesn't matter who we are by nature and what nature has planted in us and so on. For my argument to work, for the story to work, there has to be continuity between nature and morality. And there has to be a connection in such a way that nature is the first but not the last word about who we are. Okay? Nature is the first but not the last word. Nature gives us something that we don't choose. You don't choose your skin color. You don't choose whether you're born in this country or not. You don't choose whether you're born as a male or female. You don't choose whether you're born or not. Nature gives us something. Nature gives us a raw material. It's not just a brute raw material. There's a lot of gift for something for art, but not gift for that, or the other way around, right? It's gift for athletic gifts, but not gifts for high philosophical discourse and so on. So if nature is the first word, nature is not the last word. There's still work to do in each one of us. That's where development of personality is, comes into the picture, to develop gifts, to even up various tendencies and gifts that we have, to develop some that we are good at, but not to neglect all others. Because besides being unique individuals, we are also human beings, and we have to develop our humanity as well. So, for the very end, I want to phrase my questions Informing Glenn, I want you to really think about these questions. They're just two sides of the same coin. One question is this. What is the moral cost of being who you are, of being the unique individual, being the unique person that you are? What is the moral cost of being who you are? For instance, you have an artistic gift and your family wants you to go into business or to continue family business, and what do you do if you go and pursue art, you offend your family and so on and so forth. There's a moral cost in being a person. What's the moral cost of being who you are? And then reverse the coin and ask an even more important question. What is the moral cost of not being who you are? Of not living the way you may be meant to live, as we sometimes also feel. I'll stop here and I'll thank you for your attention.